โมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ One of the words this culture doesn't use is dispassion.I can't remember the last time I heard anyone say dispassion. Passion is used, of course. So if someone is passionate about music, passionate about their food, passionate about ecology, passionate about art, passionate about whatever, I guess in our culture it seemed to be on them.Most, I suppose, it seemed to be a good thing because the person's very committed to that. dispassion is... Words are just perceptions, aren't they? But dispassion, I could see, could be looked at as something which is inert, lacking in vitality. Might be a negative word.But it is certainly a word to contemplate, a word that you find in Buddhism. We also have things like, in my own inner vocabulary, and language is very personal, but in my own inner vocabulary I use reactivity and I have a difference between what a reaction is and a response is. So for me, reaction is something that does not come from any sense of wholeness or context or mindfulness, it just comes because of habit. So I react with some negative impulse or whatever. Whereas response, when I'm responsive in my own inner vocabulary, for me that is a choice I make from understanding the situation, its context, my inner motivation. So response can be passive or active, but it's more from my choosing. So the difference between being chosen, my consciousness being chosen by an emotion, reactivity, and consciousness in something I participate with mindfulness, and that I choose what to follow or not to follow. So reactivity for me is really a form of enslavement, where the impulse comes up and there's no real choice around it, and it's just reacting through the impulse. And then the consequences of that are also part of the enslavement, whereas the capacity to respond is very liberating, and it allows for the liberated mind to function in the future. So going back to passion and dispassion, all the modes of passion that one might have, or the modes of reactivity, those can be known as objects of mind. So I can feel very judgmental about myself or about others. And I can react through the judgment by just thinking critical thoughts about myself or others. I can say things from that kind of judging mind, either inner language or hurt someone or say something cutting to someone from that judging mind, or I can train a sense of awakeness to the way things are, and then a sense of the impulse of judgment, and then choosing whether or not to think through that, speak through that, or act through that. Whether to be passive or active. And that capacity, seems to me, that capacity to respond or make a choice comes from dispassion. Comes from dispassion. I think a few weeks ago I was saying one has to be careful not to grasp a position in these kinds of ideas. So quite often when one talks about judgment and non-judgment, it's very easy to grasp a position that I shouldn't be judgmental. Now that's not dispassion for me. That's just another kind of reaction to a primary reaction. So the primary reaction is judgmental, and maybe because I want to be a nice person, a secondary reaction is also judgmental. I shouldn't be judgmental. That's not dispassion. That's simply grasping the position that judgment is in some way wrong. Right? Whereas dispassion, just knowing this energy and understanding and having studied it and seeing what its consequences are and having seen its appropriateness and inappropriateness, there's no kind of absolute position about judgment, but judgment is known as a certain formation, emotional, mental formation. And there's a choice. There's a choice to drop it. If it's very, very strong, feel it in the body. If it's necessary to respond through it, to use it, critical faculty. So the judgment is neither right nor wrong, but is it appropriate? And does judgment drive consciousness? So is my life then a preoccupation with judgment, if we're using this example? Or is there this capacity, oh, this is judgment? So if we can spend the half an hour sitting, an hour sitting, 2 hours sitting, whatever amount of time, and actually practice dispassion. And how do you practice dispassion? Well, first of all, you have to be awake, be present, you have to know the present. Yeah? So the various kinds of hindrances that we get caught up into. But having established the wakefulness and the sense of presence, then when judgment arises, when fearfulness arises, when self-criticism arises, when fantasizing mind arises, all of these impulses that come up, if they are just known as impulses, then we are practicing dispassion. Now, practicing dispassion can seem very unproductive because it's not passion. And because it doesn't really give a kind of immediate sense result, like if I have a passion for ice cream, and I get a whopping great ice cream cone, and then I eat that ice cream cone, there's a very instant kind of sense experience, a strong sense experience, and that's what passion can say around. Food or greed, whatever you want to call it, is called passion. But dispassion, actually knowing, say, the impulse to have some sweet food, or and just to know that, that impulse without judgment, just to know it, doesn't seem like much. It seems, you know, doesn't have the same kind of hit as the ice cream cone. But if that dispassionate mind is allowed to function for longer periods of time. If one makes the choice to dispassion, not as some kind of religious position that thou shalt be dispassionate, not that nonsense, but actually a conscious choice as a training and as a way of understanding oneself, then that choice to practice dispassion for a while leads to a kind of insight that actually, throughout all the movement and impulses, there is this silence, which is not the same as the experience of passion. It's not the same as the ice cream cone. It's much more subtle. It's much more sort of behind and through our passionate experiences, our sense experiences. Now, to experience that, you have to allow for the seeming blandness of it, the seeming unproductiveness of it, Because as you practice dispassion, what happens is you get these conditions coming, you get thoughts coming up, and drowsiness coming up, and restlessness coming up, and memories, and right. So there's this movement going on, which is kind of coming up into consciousness. And if you're heedless, of course, consciousness just gets caught up in it. But there's this movement going on, and you're not trying to do anything about the movement. You're not judging it. If you see the tendency to judge it, you just know that judgment. You're not trying to organize it. You're not trying to figure it out. You're not trying to become anything. You're not trying to analyze it. Dispassion. And what's the result of that? What's the result of that? Well, you can only try it. You can only give it a go. But I think the result is that one begins to touch something in consciousness which is becomes much more interesting, actually, or much more worthy, or also much more solid, much more stable, and much more independent of the conditions that we usually get passionate about. So I think meditation is trying to, or is encouraging us to some extent to try that, to try to be dispassionate. So we use objects of meditation. Use the breath to compose yourself. You might use some mantra to kind of get settled. You might use a sign of silence to keep the mind very open and non-attached, spacious. But the point of the meditation isn't to get some passionate, refined experience. It's not the same as sitting down to an interesting movie and being entertained. And being entertained, you have some very good cinematography, very good music, very good acting, interesting plot, your mind is absorbed. So that's entertainment. But what comes after the entertainment is, what next? What can I go into? What will entertain me now? So that's the passionate mind, that's the mind which loves to get involved and be fascinated and be interested. There's nothing wrong with that. Yes, that's not to make moral judgments about these things, but to know the difference where the mind is seeking experience and enjoying experience. Fine. And what's the result of that? And this other, which our culture doesn't talk about, this other of abiding as witnessing, fully awake. And then watching the reactivity and choosing to just see that as impulse, just see that as impulse, just see that as impulse. And we face a lot of obstacles. It's easy to say, but most people I talk to, when they meditate, they fall asleep, their mind goes off into judging, their mind goes off into fantasy or doubting or personal histories and such like. So to actually stay awake for long periods of time is seems to be difficult for most of us, most human beings. But I think if the attitude is one, if one understands, well, what are we doing in meditation? Are we sitting here, first of all, just out of habit and just going off somewhere because we're so used to meditating? That would be unfortunate. So that happens sometimes where we become so used to meditating. This is what you do. You plunk yourself down, but there's no vitality. Consciousness just is taken by. It's a kind of reactivity. It's taken by dullness or fantasizing, and then the bell rings. Right? So that's the danger, I think, in meditative communities where meditation itself just becomes another reactive habit. So there's that. But also meditation as the attempt to get something, and to attain to something, to acquire something, to own something, to refine something down. I think it's all part of that mind which wants to get engaged with conditions. I think dispassion it's not attempting to engage in any conditions, it's just knowing the movement. So our teachings around anicca, dukkha, anatta, you're not self, don't take it personal, it's changing. Dukkha, don't grasp it, you suffer, and this kind of language that we use. And if we have the brightness and clarity and steadiness to know that condition by condition, condition by condition, condition by condition, then the mind begins to abide in silent knowing. And that's not something that's acquired through the holding of a condition, the holding of an experience, but it's sensed or known or intuited through non-grasping, through non-involvement, through non-reactivity. That's different. That's dispassion. I think that's dispassion. At least that's my inner language about it. And again, I think the odd thing about it is it doesn't really seem to get you anything. So why is this there? But where you begin to see the profit in this, or the benefit, is that when you walk around in your ordinary planetary existence, you begin to see that there's less reactivity. And you know, didn't react to that. And there is appropriate response, but the reactivity's not there. So, oh, look at that. And that kind of intuition, oh, I see, this is working different than I thought. I thought that if I get rid of this and I get rid of that and I get rid of this and I get rid of that, then I'll just be able to control things in my mind and be really happy. So there's the attempt to search for happiness as a kind of condition to get it, to organize it, to control it. So there's this movement out to get rid of something or to acquire something. But then you realize, no, that can't be it, because that's still operating in a conditioned world. So then the heart kind of steps back. Heart steps back and just feels the reactivity. Feels the reactivity. Feels the reactivity. 45 minutes of meditation. So the 45 minutes of meditation might be just an explosion of reactivities. A whole train of them, right? And then if you're judging your practice on the type of experience you had, quality of refinement, the depth of blah blah blah, you then feel like you haven't had a good meditation. But if you don't judge it that way and you see more, this the practice of dispassion requires a period of noticing passion, a period of noticing reactivity. That's what it requires. So what do you trust in, I suppose? Do you trust in conditions? Do you know how, you know, can we respond to the conditioned world in a way which is in a way where we make the choices rather than we being chosen? We make the choice to respond to a person, to a situation, to an encounter. We make the choice. So reactivity as opposed to response, passion, as opposed to dispassion. So if you want to be passionate about something, that's fine. Be passionate about it. But what's the limit of passion? Where's the limitation of passion? In the text, we're taught that the contemplative sees the attraction or the enthrallment of things, sees the danger of things, and sees the freedom from things. Sees the enthrallment in the sense world, the attraction of it, sees the danger in that, or sees the limitation of that, and sees the way to be liberated from that. So passion can be, you know, like, it can be very, very, it can really draw you and can excite you and can make you happy at a certain level, but it always has a limitation. And if one is totally dependent on passion, if one is dependent on the body or the senses or finances or whatever, then when that avenue of passion is blocked, then one has, and one has no spiritual life, then of course there's depression and disappointment. Now when we face things like loss, disappointment, misunderstandings, when we are accused falsely, or, you know, these difficulties that we human beings get thrown at us, like the experience of loss and disappointment. Now, if you had a practice of dispassion, and someone accuses me falsely, cruelly about something that I've been engaged in a very good way, and I get accused of the opposite, that I've been foolish or negligent. Now, the reactive heart, that's very difficult, isn't it? When there is like a strong sense of betrayal like that, right? So the reactive heart feels it very, very strongly. But if one has spent time practicing dispassion, then of course there's this underlying foundation and strength to know the power of that, but also to not be deluded by the power of that. And so one might have to sit through days, many, many days of anger, or because the betrayal has been so difficult, or the loss has been so powerful, of grief or whatever. But in the practice of dispassion, that's fine. That's grief, or that's anger, but the dispassionate mind can know passion. So then you get these ideas of purification, where some reactivity has come up into the heart and one hasn't believed in it. One hasn't created a self around it. One hasn't tried to repress it. One hasn't gone to self-judgment and all the nonsense that we do around this, and simply recognized it as a movement, as a passionate movement, and abided in that sense of knowing. And the feeling isn't beautiful. The experience isn't comfortable. Loss is not a comfortable experience. Disappointment is not a comfortable experience. But having abided with a clear sense of knowing on that, the result is very good. On two levels, the result is good. On one level, that the heart has stayed home, and one has endured this difficulty, and so the capacity for dispassion, the capacity for awareness has been very, very much empowered. If I have the strength of mind to stay with something which is very hurtful or disappointing, the power of awareness is very, very, very much strengthened, because those are the things we run away from or blame. So that's on one hand. And on the other hand, the power of the delusions, the power of disappointment to delude us, the power of loss to overwhelm us, that's lessened. So it's kind of compounded goodness. You know, it's like goodness squared, where awareness is strengthened and the reactivity is weakened, and the delusion of reactivity and the need for engagement with a sense will, that need falls away more and more. So that the world of sense can be engaged with, but it's not a necessity. One has a deeper foundation. All right, leave that for your reflection.
Vayam lavaratamagataya sadhu karandhidamasai.